This is a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. Go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
Into it, you're more likely to hear a reflection of real life. And 3CR being in the heart of Smith Street, Collingwood, is a particularly good example of what I'm talking about. If you'd like to subscribe, the number is 94198377.
You've been listening to the sand. You could never understand. Feel the force.
Ask a scientist to design a better violin and you get a dirty look. While the instrument seems to be simple, the science behind it is not. Such is bicycle stability. The machine appears uncomplicated, but the theories governing its motion are nightmarish. Some things just can't be easily defined by politics and mathematics. The interaction of the body, mind, muscles, terrain, gravity, air, and the bicycle are so complex that they defy exact mathematical solutions. The feel and handling of a bicycle borders on art. Like a violin, it has been largely designed by tough inspiration and experimentation. And that's from Chester Kyle.
Well, we know where we're going, but we don't know where we've been. And we know what we're knowing, but we can't say what we've seen. And we're not little children, and we know what we want. Work it out.
The future certainly is turning. Here you're listening to the Arabug Radio Show on Radical Radio 3CR, 855 on the AM dial. Podcasting, streaming, or listening on that old transistor in the kitchen. Many thanks to Amy Goodman and Naomi Shafi for Democracy Now! Always a look into the window of the soul, independent soul of America. God, they've been going for 30 years. And need I remind everybody that's listening, 3CR is entering, it's about to start its 51st year of broadcasting in Melbourne. On the 4th of July this year will be our birthday, and of course Radiothon is coming up. We've got a bit of a show today. I'm joined by Nick Dow from Melbourne Bug. Good morning, Nick.
Hi, and the Black and Tan Kelpie.
And Black and Tan
Kelpie. She's not saying much.
I would think I'd be offended by not being introduced by name.
Yeah, I'll ask her.
And I'm sure she...
No, she prefers to remain anonymous.
Oh, there we go, the black dog. We're going to have a look at a couple of things. Norma, a little bit of news, a little bit of personal reflection with the bike moment, and a quick look at... We're trying to do two things today, which is always a bit tough. Perception as far as safety inside in bicycle lanes especially, and a little look at the history of ghost bikes. Where did they start? Where did they come from? What's their reflection, or what do they reflect about us? So, Nick, you got a bike moment to share with us?
Look, a very ordinary day for us. Nothing special, but this is what we do most days. You know, Melbourne's such a stupidly spread out city, but bike and train is just a fantastic way to beat that. Anyway, yep. We caught the train down to Sandringham. We rode to Dandenong.
When was this?
Oh, this was Saturday.
Yeah.
Rode to Dandenong, but via Mordialloc Cellar Door for lunch. Little plug there, great place.
Yep.
And on the way, the aforementioned Kelpie had a great swim chasing sticks in Port Phillip Bay. And we were joined by some friends who look after her sometimes and... on the beach and also down at Mordialloc Cellar Door. So, and then after lunch, rode on various trails and ended up on Dandenong Creek Trail, get back to Dandenong Railway Station. Just a typical day for us.
Yeah.
And, you know, I loved your introduction about the science of the bicycle, but another thing that science does have no idea about is just the sheer joy of riding. sweeping around corners, rattling down gravel roads. It's just such fun.
I was up walking dog this morning, actually, and I went for a ride after the ride to return on Sunday. I went for a bit of a ride along the river anyway. But this morning, just sunrise, hardly a breath of wind. Well, no breath of wind, not a cloud in the sky, a waning gibbous moon sitting high in the sky. It really is sometimes makes you sit up and just look at things from a different way, doesn't it?
Mm.
There's a show about bicycles. But look, it's interesting that I think it's been studied a fair bit, Nick. Hard to fit a cyclist in an MRI machine and track their brain wires while they're doing it. And because it's so tied to being in nature as being surrounded by that, I think is... But obviously, I mean, all those quotes, you know, you can't cry and pedal at the same time. I love cycling because even though I've ridden the same road 1,000 times, I still don't know what's around
and
the next
corner.
Even
when you're not in nature, fighting the traffic in Sydney Road is pretty exhilarating at times.
Well, interesting you say that. It does actually, and it's interesting that, look, my bike moments, I'm continually amazed but continually... in love with the regeneration, rebirth of Critical Mass. Now, the ride at the end of May was really well attended and really well done. And it's a credit to an idea that keeps living. It's morphed. Yes, we all understand that. But I've got to say...
it's a new generation.
Yeah, and it's a happy, friendly ride.
And shout out to Bike Rave because they were there in numbers with us.
Yep.
Bike Rave.
Yeah. Which we've had on the show a couple of times. I think we had them on the show 13 years ago at one stage, Nick. Hey, listen, let's swing on to a little bit of news. June the 3rd was World Bicycling Day, and I should just add that actually there's another day that somebody, the Americans, celebrate, 19th of April, as Bicycle Day, and I'll just give you a bit of a history of why the 19th of April is classified as Bicycle Day in the US. That's the day that... young Albert Hoffman ingested some of his own cooked LSD in 1943 in his lab in Bern, then got on his bicycle and rode home. And obviously he experienced the first trip while aboard his bicycle. So it's celebrated for quite big as Bicycle Day in America. I'm not too sure where the International World Cycling Day came from.
That was last Wednesday then.
Yeah.
A bunch of us rode up to Eltham.
There we go. So, look, we've all been watching a little bit with a little bit with heavy hearts and wire observation, the attitude of the Queensland government to electric mobility devices, electric bikes, electric scooters, everything that comes under that that umbrella. Now, the piece of legislation was passed, as I say, on the 3rd of June, and I'm just going to quote a little bit of some of the Minister for Major Roads and Transport, who is...
Dimwit.
Brent Mickleberg, and this is just a quote from him. We promised to deliver national-leading laws about who can ride, what they can ride, where they can ride, and how fast. And our laws will do exactly that. What a promise.
We will decide who can ride and how they will ride.
Oh, yes, and at what speed you will ride. Look, if you haven't, this is not a simple piece of legislation. I think it went through with 122, I think, amendments to the original piece of legislation. So it'll be interesting to see what happens to it and what's come out of it. Because obviously as somebody pointed out, I mean, the poor police can't go around. If they started impounding all the illegal bicycles, You're going to store all those lithium batteries at the local police shop?
No, you know, sure they'll be recycled.
It'll be a nightmare. Well, they're all the unsafe batteries. Anyway, let's just see what happens. It looks like it's going to be a logistical nightmare. Hey, listen, we're going to take this message from Bicycle Network, and then we're going to come back and we'll talk about perceptions of safety.
Yarrabug would like to thank Bicycle Network for their financial support. Bicycle Network, a not-for-profit with 45,000 members, working to get more people riding for their health and well-being. Bicycle Network is proud to sponsor the Yarrabug program and support its important advocacy for safer and more accessible riding. By becoming a Bicycle Network member and or participating in one of their iconic riding events, you're supporting Bicycle Network's Ride to School programs and advocacy campaigns to make it easier for everyone to ride a bike every day. Visit bicyclenetwork.com.au for more information.
You're back listening to Radical Radio here on 3CR. Now, look, it's an interesting thing what we perceive to be safe. Sometimes somebody's safe path is somebody's quite scary path. So perception can be a completely individual look at something, but actually it does highlight some design issues, I would think. I'll go through a couple of things. Albert Street Bike Lane was one of the first ones to become in Melbourne. So this is pre-Swanston Street. So, and if you look at the infrastructure now, you realise that bike lane is very narrow.
That's because of the East Melbourne NIMBYs.
Yeah, well, there we go. It is actually, I mean, it was all celebrated as being first, but if you ride it today, it doesn't pass my perception of safety test. It's interesting. I mean, I know this is very individual. I ride up Clarendon Street to get to Albert Street, most of my normal things. Actually, the perception of safety on that on-road bike path up Albert Street, I know it's only a short road and it doesn't carry the traffic that...
Up Clarendon Street, you mean?
Up Clarendon Street from the MCG, yeah, back the other way day. So it's a car space. It's 600 mil of blocked-off lane. Then at the widest bike lane, it's 2.1, I think, metres, so much wider than what would we consider a normal width bike lane now. Then another 600 mils of painted stripes and a rumble strip. So I've virtually got 4 metres from the car door to the car line, the driveway. So it's a really big gap that gives you plenty of room to avoid things, pedestrians stepping into it, stuff like that.
Lots of room for cars to park in.
Yeah. And look, I actually perceive that as safer than that downhill bit on Albert Street after you go across Clarendon heading down towards Hoddle Street. That's one of the sketchiest, scariest parts of a separated bike line I've ever been on. I'm just wonder, how do you marry the two? What's the indicator? Well, personally for you, tell me a place where you can notice the difference.
Where I feel safe or don't feel safe.
Yeah, but apart from, you know, trying to ride up Hoddle Street on a Tuesday morning.
Oh, yeah, I take the lane in Hoddle Street too. I don't know. I mean, you know, the problem with Clarendon Street is when you go and heading south is the hook is people left hooking you as you turn through there. But, yeah, look, nothing is completely safe. I mean, I certainly prefer the protected lanes in Albert Street compared to what was there before, which was nothing.
Yep.
Just the door zone. they're way too narrow, of course. But what you're talking about, of course, is perceived safety. Now, look, I haven't researched it lately, but the crash stats in Clarendon Street are very good. I mean, and there's a lot of people use it. So, but perceived safety is actually really important because it's what determines how many people will ride a bike, by and large.
Yeah.
It's one of the main factors. As opposed to, you know,
I think it's a number one factor, actually.
Well, yeah. As opposed to statistical safety, which is just how many people do get injured or killed. And about that, you can certainly say that riding a bike is actually quite a safe way to get around, statistically. You know, your chances of anything serious happening are really quite low, but it doesn't feel like that when you're riding, and that puts what puts people off. And we've all had, you know, near misses or scares. And it just becomes visceral, you know. And when you hear about an accident that does occur, or I shouldn't even call it an accident, when someone does get injured or killed, you really feel it because you experience that fear every day, even though objectively it's. I mean, I've never been seriously injured in 62 years of riding a bike around Melbourne, but I still have that visceral fear. And for me, that's... Can I get into white bikes?
I want to see this segue.
Well, which is for me, it's why I've started helping to get white painted bikes out on the streets and particular sites where someone has been killed mostly. Because it's just very meaningful to me.
And it's a visceral reminder.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of reasons. I mean, getting beyond my motivation, there's a lot of reasons for it. I mean, we've started putting little notes on the bikes with a name and a date and who killed them. so it's a bit educational. Like, most people wouldn't have a clue what the bike was for, but if they stop and read that little thing, they know. It's a memorial. And it's also just a gut reaction of our feelings. So that, I think, is pretty universal as to ghost bikes. You can tell us where they originate.
Let's step back a little bit. So we're going to draw a line between a white bike that's got a political history and a ghost bike. So white bikes were the symbol of an anarchist group that stood for city council in Amsterdam in the 60s. So the myth that then there were all these white bikes in Amsterdam, they made about six of them. But the point was, they were going to put a freeway through the middle of Amsterdam, central to the train station, virtually ruin what has now become a tourist mecca. Anyway, it actually kick-started cycling activism in Amsterdam in particular. And it was this one group idea that came out of an anarchist group, free bikes, paint them white, leave them where you are. So that rebirthed something. It would never actually worked. Although, if you go to the Netherlands a bit, and you've ever been to the Kroller-Müller Museum, I'm getting a bit of topic here, which is an enormous parkland. It's about an hour's train ride out of Amsterdam. And there's one road in there that only takes a bus that goes in there. But there are three entrances to them, and at every entrance there are about 50 white bikes. So the whole park's full of cycling things. That's where I've seen white bikes. So that's a white bike, and we can say it's used as sculpture. Think of Ai Weiwei's bicycle triangle here at the NGV many years ago. The ghost bike is, I'm first recorded, I've got it according to Wikipedia, is about 2003. In St. Louis, Missouri, actually, is where it started. And so, Nick, it's always, this is a bicycle that's then painted white and usually chained close to the spot where a cyclist had been killed. I'm right in thinking, and from what I've read, there's always permission granted from the family of the cyclist.
Oh, no. No. I mean, there is often communication.
Yep.
I don't recall an incident where there's ever been permission as such.
I mean, I framed that wrongly. But keeping the family in the loop about what was going on.
Yeah, where we can. Yes, that's right. In the recent batch of ghost bikes, we've had a couple stolen from us by the City of Melbourne, but we've only had one just randomly stolen, the family of Will has given us a replacement bike.
Oh, this was
there.
At Kensington Railway Station.
So we were working definitely working with Will's family on that one.
Yeah.
But generally, I mean, your Kako's bike in King Street, I know people have been in communication with a family. I don't know if they know there's a ghost bike there.
Is the one on Sydney Road still there? I forgot the name.
Yeah, yeah. It's Alberto still Pollan's bike is out the front of Berkeley Square. So I'm mentioning where these bikes are, so you can have a look as you go past and see them.
And we should just reframe. A lot of councils pull them off if it looks like an advertising bike. Is that one of the rules? If it looks like the bike is a piece sculpture instead of an actually working bike?
When you say a lot of councils, I have no experience of any council other than the City of Melbourne removing a ghost
removing
bike.
Removing them,
and indeed, Moreland Council phoned the Bug and said, oh, look, that bike's looking pretty bad. Do you want to do something about it? They were actually cooperative. The City of Melbourne has removed bikes from Swanson Street, but they seem to be they don't seem to be worried anywhere else. So we're fitting in with that now. Unfortunately, there isn't a ghost bike for the Carolyn Rollins and her unborn child. They were killed by a bus driver in Swanson Street after the council had been warned over and over again that the buses were dangerous.
You want me to replay this story again and again? They had a meeting, the three of them, the bus drivers, the Melbourne City Council, and Bicycle Victoria. And the safety report was done on the interaction between pedestrian cycling and the tourism buses, and it was found to be unsafe. Those three groups then said, no, let's wait a year and see what happens.
Well, we saw what happened.
3 months later, Carolyn Rawlings and unborn child were dead, yes. So...
yeah, there's one ghost bike we've put in front of the Department of Transport, which doesn't mark a particular spot. It's just a reminder to the people in there. And damn it, I didn't bring it with me, but we've got a Latin piece of Latin on it. I don't know why it's in Latin. Translated means blood before action, because of all the times when it's been well known we've asked for safety to be improved and then something's happened over and over again.
Yeah. So you've got a two-edged sword. I mean, we just, the perception of cycling being a dangerous sport, and if you're reminding somebody continually that here is the spot that the cyclist died.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, but the thing is, we're always campaigning for safer roads. And
why wouldn't somebody honour somebody who's actually... it's a long history, human history, of honouring the dead for different reasons.
Yeah, I mean, we do it for ourselves.
Yeah.
We do it for the families. You know, I guess I doubt that people who drive in their cars probably don't know what it is, but maybe sometimes they walk past. That is something we've started doing is, as I said, putting an annotation on there so people actually know what the bike is there for. But, you know, look, it's part of the broader picture. I mean, it doesn't stop those of us who are riding bikes. Let's see a ghost bike, I think, doesn't stop us from riding.
No.
I think it actually helps.
Yeah.
And there's a little team of people that monitor each bike. So people who go to work that way or pass that way are looking after each bike.
They're not some static.
Sticking flowers on them.
Yeah.
And if a bike gets stolen or damaged, we'll replace it.
Yeah. They're not just a static thing. They're actually a reminder. And then actually, as you say, people are watchful over them.
Yeah, yeah.
Hey, listen, I've got to tell you this story of... do you remember the early 2008, just before the financial crash? And if you remember at that time, so we've got mobile phones, we haven't got computers in our hands. Mobile phones are talk and text and messages only. Mm-hmm. So... well, whole new millennium generation. Now everybody's trying to work out how to sell. Marketing has become the biggest thing. I mean, I think, you know, Nike spent more money on advertising than it did on, you know, it was 20 times manufacturing costs and stuff like that. How to market and how to market a brand was becoming a big thing. And, of course, how to speak to a younger generation had flummoxed marketers. I mean, they were used to doing a glossy magazine wrap for, you know, Vanity Fair, for something like that. But advertising obviously was changed. So New York City has not got a great reputation at that stage for killing cyclists. And actually, I don't think one motorist ever served a custodial sentence for killing a cyclist in New York City. I still don't think one ever has. So, and the ghost bikes were a way of homaging those cyclists in Manhattan, especially. So a fashion group, I'm going to say their name, DNKY, marketing department, come with a great idea. Why don't we pinch the idea of the ghost bikes, but we'll paint them a neon orange colour with our initials on it. And what's the little square that you put on something you want somebody to download? They were just starting in those days.
Way back then, wow.
I think so. Well, that's what I've read anyway. So obviously an advertising campaign riding on the back of an idea of the ghost bike. And they must have put about 250 out of them in Manhattan, chaining them everywhere. So you can imagine the backlash from the New York City cycling community was just livid. So within 2 weeks, nearly all of them are gone. Some of them sawed in half so they could take them off. A lot of them, some of them taken down by the city because they were chained up to public property. But it was interesting. They didn't last 2 weeks. And look, I'd known about this story but could never actually place where I'd picked it up. So over the weekend doing a bit of research, and then I really tracked down on this. The really interesting part of this story, I've got a bit of time, is that actually then the cycling community got... So DKNY did this because it was in the middle of... It was the lead up to and during New York City's Fashion Week. You know, how they have, you know... It's like bringing, you know, I'm not too sure how cities always have these, you know, things. We have Fashion Week here, I think, for goodness sake. Yep. Anyway, you can imagine it's a big thing in New York City, obviously. So to the big launch at one of the squares, a whole group of cycling activists showed up. Now, they'd painted their own bikes or painted other bikes the same bright neon orange, and... They'd put signs on them saying, you know, DKNY demands safe bike lanes. DKNY. So in a lot of ways, they'd reverse the culture jam on DKNY and laid at the DKNY's feet the idea, we're going out of the reason these bikes are out there is we're advocating for safe cycling. Of course, the message from the DKNY marketing decision didn't really gel with that, but I think they took it in the end. But it was an interesting idea that I'm telling the story because here's an idea that does have a bit of, I'm going to say, what are you going to say, sacredness to it?
Mm.
There's a bit of, you know, something that should not be touched idea about a ghost bike.
Yeah, and also I love the anarchist response, and this, you know, it just shows you what we can do.
Yes, yeah. I mean, poking fun at people is the greatest way to bring down idiots. I mean, for goodness sake, satire is invented for this. But to then turn that jam, turn it and jam it back round on them was great. And then stage the whole...
You love to see it.
Whole theatrical thing involving, well, you know, the major sponsor for the New York City Fashion Week was Mercedes-Benz. So then they staged a the whole gang of cyclists climbing over a paper mache Mercedes Benz. So it was obviously a nice bit of street theatre to go with it too.
Culture jamming.
Yeah, yeah. Hey Nick, lovely to have you on again.
Thank you, Val.
Not my King's Day holiday here in Melbourne. So
is it a holiday?
It is. I wish it was for something
else.
Bike
ride.
That's a good idea, and there's not much traffic on the road, and it's a beautiful day. Find a garden somewhere, get on a train, go down to the Cheetham Wetlands. It'd be magic down there past Altona today. There's some really good spots to ride a bike in Melbourne, and a good time to find one because you won't be paying much for the train. That's all we got time for this week. Chris and Steve will be along next week, but next up... is I think it's usually lost in science, and I'll play that then.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.